Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, December 17th, 1900, Ellis Island in New York Harbor opens as an immigration inspection station. On the day, it welcomed over 2,000 immigrants to the United States. The island had been used as an immigration facility a few years earlier, but that building burned down. And this was the opening of the fancy new building and would turn Ellis Island into Ellis Island. In many ways, the symbol of the American immigrant experience, at least in the first few decades of the 20th century. I don't really need to play up the significance of Ellis Island, both in terms of the way the immigrants who came through there transformed this country, but also the place it has in the public imagination. So let's just get into this segment. I will say, though, that I really like doing something in 1900. Nikki, we've done I was looking at all the years we've done it with 1834 and 1917 and all this stuff. And it's just 1900, nice and clean. That's not the only reason we're doing this, but I do like the cleanliness of that.
But mostly for the nice round number.
Yes, exactly. It'll just be easier to type when I post
That's
the episode.
Right.
Fewer characters.
It'll be easier to do math when you're trying to figure out how far away it was.
Exactly. That, of course, is Nicole Hemmer of Columbia. Hello, Nikki.
Hello, Jody.
And our guest for this episode, our very special guest, is Brian Lehrer, host of The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Brian, thank you for coming on.
Hi, Jody. Hi, Nikki.
And I will say that I was a producer on Brian's show for many years. I think Brian is the voice of New York City and the best radio host in the country. But thank you for being a guest on this program. Brian, you've been on WNYC for a long, long time. Did you broadcast live that day in 1900 that Ellis Island opened?
Well, I was just back from the Spanish-American War, of course, helping the United States establish American imperialism around the world for the very first time.
I thought you looked like a Rough Rider.
Not on the air that long.
Not quite that long.
Yeah, but let's start actually maybe just describing the island itself. I mean, you want to kind of paint the picture of where it sits in New York City?
Well, Ellis Island is in New York Harbor. It's right by Liberty Island, which houses the Statue of Liberty. So they are like a pair. And of course, they're so intertwined. People think of the Statue of Liberty and Emma Lazarus's poem in conjunction with immigration. But it wasn't Liberty Island, it was Ellis Island right by it that people actually went through. And part of it is in New York and part of it is in New Jersey. And they have actually squabbled and even gone to the Supreme Court over who owns it. And I think it turns out to be over 80% New Jersey. But that's a little footnote of history. Yeah.
But Nikki, what is the historical context here in 1900 for, you know, let's think of this as a building, a big new facility that needs to do some work. Why do they need to build a big new facility in this place at this time?
For a couple of reasons. I mean, one reason is this is near the start of federal control of immigration. So before this point, immigration was controlled in the U.S. It wasn't that people could just come in willy-nilly, but it was largely done by the states. So the federal government is going to take over this role of controlling immigration. And it's happening at a time that immigration into the United States has changed dramatically. So starting probably about 10 years earlier in 1890, the pace of immigration to the U.S. from Europe was escalating rapidly. It was so much higher than in any previous period, and it was coming from different places. So instead of coming primarily from Britain, a little bit from Germany, from Nordic countries. Now it's coming from Southern and Eastern Europe. And that's changing the type of immigrant that's coming to the U.S., the number of migrants who are coming to the U.S. And now there's this new system that's filtering those migrants into the U.S. as well.
And by the way, Ellis Island, little known fact, talk about obscure history. Who was Ellis? Oh. Samuel Ellis was a businessman who, at the time, you know, when private citizens owned these islands, owned the land, the public didn't own Ellis Island, as I understand it. Around the time the Revolutionary War began, I believe 1775, this guy, Samuel Ellis, bought it from some other guy and set up a bar there. Where fishermen would stop and eat and drink. And then when the federal government took it over after he died, they kept his name, which is actually incredible to me. Yeah. You know, why is it still named after this guy who happened to own a bar and own the island until it became public land when there are so many other people who could, you know, represent what Ellis Island has become, who it could be named after, but it's still named after this bar owner guy Samuel Ellis. I don't know if, Nikki, you have anything to add to that.
Well, yeah, I mean, the prehistory of these islands before it becomes sort of Ellis Island is fascinating because it's not just that it has this bar and is named after this guy named Samuel Ellis, but it was part of these like three oyster islands that were constantly moving in and out of private and public ownership. And this particular island, I mean, it was this place where they would hang pirates who were convicted of high crimes. It was this place where once the federal government got involved, the army used to store massive amounts of gunpowder, which made people really nervous because they were like, wait, please don't stockpile explosives this close to a major city in the U.S. So it has this kind of rich and lively history prior to becoming this immigration stop.
And you mentioned the oysters. I think it was also once known as Oyster Island for all the oysters. And, you know, I don't know about eating shellfish in New York Harbor these days, but I guess at one time that was a thing to do.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I wouldn't do it today, but they used to be all over the harbor.
Yeah, I mean, this gets to this larger thing that I think about all the time, which is New York City is a city of water, and people don't tend to think of that, but we really are. And, you know, I think more and more our relationship with water is starting to come back a little bit more. But it's funny you bring up Ellis, Brian, because this makes me think that this really is, even more than I thought, a New York story when we're talking about real estate, drinking, federal land, and of course, immigration and the way that that shaped this city. And so, Brian, what is your sense in the context of what Nikki described of the way immigration was shifting and immigrant communities were shifting to the United States, how that immigration shaped New York City in the first couple decades of after Ellis Island opened?
Right. Well, the conception that other people would have of New York City certainly would include a lot of Italians, a lot of Jews, a lot of Irish. Irish came before primarily, but as Ellis Island was opening, there were a lot of people coming in from Southern Europe. As Nikki was saying, immigration was changing in that way. I mean, you know, there was the time maybe a century before when a lot of Germans were coming and the English thought the Germans were unassimilable. And then the Germans thought the Irish were unassimilable. And then they all thought the Italians were unassimilable and called them black, I think.
They did.
And you know, all four of my grandparents probably came through Ellis Island as Jews from Poland. I know for sure my maternal grandmother, and funny enough, my parents, who I double checked with just before I went on with you.
Oh, yeah.
That's my research, as I call mom and dad. They weren't entirely sure if my father's parents or my mother's father also came through Ellis Island. But part of the story is that there was a class system. So as I understand it, and as I've gotten it through family lore, as well as my understanding of history, if you had enough money to buy a second class ticket, I believe it was called, or something higher, you didn't go through Ellis Island. You got screened maybe on the ship. And it was really only if you didn't have money and went through, I guess they call it steerage, that you wound up getting screened more heavily through Ellis Island and having to wade through this hours long process. Family lore on my mother's side of the family is that my mother's mother and some of her relatives who came with her had enough money to buy second class tickets, but they got stolen in Europe. They didn't have enough money to rebuy them. And so they did come through steerage, did come through Ellis Island. And there were two people in that group who were sick. One had conjunctivitis, so they were seen to have red eyes and were held up for a while, and she got through. And the other one was much sicker. She got the Spanish flu, right? She had serious health problems and had to kind of hope that they wouldn't pick up on that because they would have sent her back, is my understanding. Yeah. But they didn't pick up on it, and the family breathed a sigh of relief.
And one element of that, as I gather, when ships would come into the harbor, their first stop was actually Manhattan. And it would let off first class passengers and then circle back and let off third class and steerage passengers at Ellis Island and process them through there, which I think just sort of undercuts that romantic notion we have of coming into New York Harbor, seeing Ellis Island, seeing the Statue of Liberty, and everyone having this immigrant experience. If your first immigrant experience is you land and you get to watch all the rich people get off the boat first, and then you have to go somewhere else. That probably actually complicates a little bit of that romantic notion.
Yeah, it does get you used to life in America.
I suppose.
I would say that Brian's story is more emblematic of what most immigrants went through and does puncture some of that romance, because it is a long inspection process. There's a detailed medical inspection. It sent 2% of the people who passed through Ellis Island, which is a significant number of people, back to their port of origin. And then also there were all kinds of reasons why you could be detained or sent back. If you were believed to be a potential public charge, you could be sent back or not let through. If you had political beliefs that didn't gel right with people in the United States. So if you were an anarchist or a Bolshevik, you could be turned away. If they believed you were a criminal or engaged in immoral practices, you could be turned away. If you were a woman, you couldn't leave Ellis Island with a man who you weren't related to. So there were all of these ways in which you were already running into barriers to entry to the United States, which I think is important because we do have a very romantic image of people filtering through Ellis Island. And this being an era where there weren't really immigration controls, but at Ellis Island, there really were.
So they turned back women who were believed to be prostitutes.
Yep.
But they didn't turn back men who were believed to be johns.
That's typically how it works still in America today. The person who is engaged in sex work tends to be punished a lot more than the person who facilitates it.
The other element that's part of this romantic story, and I think it can be complicated as well, is this notion of names getting changed at Ellis Island. Brian, is there any family lore in the Lehrer family about your name getting changed?
Not that I know of. No, Lehrer is a German name that means teacher. Some people take it to mean learner, so it could be either side of that equation. But since it's a German word, it seemed to be in the family in Europe for many, many generations and unchanged at Ellis Island.
Yeah. And a lot of families tell themselves a story. A lot of immigrants have a story that their name got changed and Anglicanized in Ellis Island. And that actually doesn't appear to be the case. I mean, it's mostly the case that what was happening at Ellis Island was they were checking the manifest against who was coming off the boat, and they weren't actually changing names. They were mostly just like checking names off a box. And I think people changed their names maybe a little later in their immigrant experience when they were trying to get a job or when they got married or, you know, for other reasons. But that's, I think, one of the stickiest myths about Ellis Island is that, you know, they came in and said, and some enterprising person behind a desk said, no, I'm going to give you a more American name right now on the spot.
Yes, the immigrants had much more agency in that process than we are generally led to believe. And we should say that Ellis Island wasn't in service that long for how central it is to American mythology. As we mentioned at the top of the show, it opens in 1900. You know, so ultimately, as immigration dies down in the United States, you have in the 1940s, Ellis Island is used to hold POWs, so people who are seen as enemy aliens or enemy combatants from Germany, Italy, and Japan. And then by 1954, it just closes down and collapses into disrepair for the better part of a decade.
Yeah. And then for much of the time since 1954, it has fallen into a little bit of a land dispute, a classic New York, New Jersey land dispute. We won't get into that, but if people want to go check that section of the Wikipedia pages, I'll give it a B+. It's mildly interesting. But
it's no Toledo War.
It's no Toledo War, but if you're a connoisseur of New York, New Jersey spats, as Brian and I are, it's a good one to check out. So it really is in those first two decades that seems to be the height of immigration, if you look at the numbers through Ellis Island. What starts to change? Is there a law that starts to change things, Nikki?
There is a law that starts to change them, a couple of them, actually. There's a real move in response to this new immigration towards nativism and immigration restriction. And there are a lot of laws attempted in the late 19-teens, but in 1921 and 1924, you get these immigration restriction laws that are based on quotas. And the 1924 law is a quota based on the 1890 census, which means that it's only allowing in the people who were arriving in 1890. So we're talking about Northern and Western Europeans, by and large. And only 2% of the numbers that were coming in 1890. So it is a dramatic shrinking of the numbers of people and where those people come from who can come into the United States. And that fundamentally remakes what immigration looks like. There's no real need for Ellis Island anymore after this law is passed. And that's the big part of the reason why it winds down.
And, you know, hosting a current affairs show, people who support, let's say, the Donald Trump, Stephen Miller immigration restrictionist point of view will point to this history and say it's a natural ebb and flow in U.S. history, that there are periods where many, many, many immigrants come in, the millions in the Ellis Island period. There was, you know, an earlier big wave and then a bit of retrenchment and then the big wave during Ellis Island's decades. And then they will argue that there needs to be a sort of digesting process, you know, as those many millions of new people become Americanized and assimilate, not necessarily in the bad sense of that word, into life in the US and into the US economy. And that we've been in another one of those phases since the 1965 Immigration Act all the way to today, with so many immigrants, legal as well as undocumented. And so it's time for a pause again. And they will make that argument and say, this is a rational thing, that a country that takes in many, many immigrants, you know, should go through as a reasonable cycle. So just saying, whether we agree with that argument or not, it recalls that moment that you were just talking about where nativism rose after a period of mass migration.
But I do think at some fundamental level, it is a real lesson of history to just realize that this has always been a country that has pulled the levers of immigration, you know, and has gone through different periods doing so. I mean, I think to state the obvious, that, you know, the other part of looking to history is to realize that we've all benefited from immigration. And if our forefathers benefited from immigration, then people now should as well. So the lessons of history sort of cut in both ways.
And of course, something rational connects with something that is pure xenophobia. Yeah. And one can leverage the other. And, you know, maybe that distrust of anybody we consider the other in human nature is so deeply rooted that if there's an excuse, like I think one of the excuses at the end of World War One, which is around when Ellis Island immigration started to wane, and, you know, leading up to that first law in 1921, it was just a couple years after the end of World War One, there was a Red Scare at that time, right? They didn't want, you said Bolsheviks, Nikki, they didn't want Bolsheviks coming in. But then I think it connected with this xenophobia that people had and the fact that they didn't like a lot of Jews coming in and a lot of Italians coming in. And how do you pick apart what was sort of rational national policy and what was just hate and fear and racism and xenophobia? We got to say it was all in there.
Yeah. And it can be difficult to have those conversations about what the motivations were, because so much of this history gets wiped out in some ways, or we just don't tell it in detail. We think of the U.S. prior to the 20th century as a place with no immigration restrictions, right? We think of the U.S. as restricting based on national origin, but not on political ideology. But of course, in this period, people were being turned away left and right because of what their politics were, which would seem to clash with our ideas of the U.S. as this place where you have a First Amendment right to whatever politics that you want. And so because we don't tell accurate enough things about our past, it's difficult to draw good lessons from them.
Yeah. Let's start to wrap up a little bit. But Brian, I mean, I wonder if we can talk a little bit just about how immigrants have shaped New York and the sort of story of immigration in particular as related to New York. Your show is such a home for immigrant voices and sort of, you know, really does treat New York as a city of immigrants. And I'm just wondering, like, over the course of your time on the radio, like how you've seen immigration change and shape this city and different immigrant communities leave their mark on New York City over the last 30, 40 years.
Well, you know, doing what we call a local radio show. And there is a national element. I guess I might as well plug it. There's a thing called Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast. But doing primarily a local show, our definition of local is anything of interest to people in the New York listening area. And that winds up including so many things that are international because everybody lives here. When you look at New York today, there are so many nationalities here in fairly large numbers because of the Immigration Act of 1965, which reopened immigration after 40 years of restriction after the Ellis Island era and the 1920s laws that Nikki was talking about that shut it down. Now there are people here from everywhere in fairly substantial numbers, Koreans and Chinese and Indians and Jamaicans and Dominicans, But people who had footholds here, those groups started to explode so much. The biggest immigrant group to New York since 1965, as I understand it, is people from the Dominican Republic, which is not a big country. New York is majority either foreign-born or the children of foreign-born, and they're from everywhere. You can't identify an individual place.
And I guess one thing I want to chat about, Nikki, is just sort of with Ellis Island in particular, how much it has helped shape a story of immigration. And I mean, you know, maybe it's just the opening scenes of The Godfather, but I feel like, you know, that image of a steamship coming into New York Harbor and immigrants with their face pressed against the glass and looking out and seeing the Statue of Liberty and seeing Ellis Island. I mean, it's such a powerful story. And obviously, such fodder for being romanticized. And I think about the immigrant experience today. I mean, my wife teaches at a school for new immigrants, and most of the students who end up at her school, you know, cross the border at night under cover of darkness, ended up in a detention center, ended up on a bus to a family member they'd never really met in New York City. And they end up, you know, they don't have that romanticized story. Not to say that one was more difficult than the other or whatever, but I just wonder kind of, Nikki, how much you feel like, because there isn't that tidy story, that tidy visual anymore, maybe we think of immigration differently.
Well, I think we do. But again, like that tidy story never quite was the story. You did have that amazing moment of coming into the harbor, of seeing the Statue of Liberty, of seeing New York's skyline. And that, of course, is very powerful. But then that experience of detention, that experience of shuttling off into parts unknown, that was what happened for many people. Yeah. Not a lot, you know, not everyone stayed in New York. They went into the interior to meet up with family or to go to a frontier that they knew nothing about. And so there is something that I think lives on in our immigration story about the Statue of Liberty and the Emma Lazarus poem on the base and this very romantic notion that I think is important to our understanding of what it means to be an American. But I think that it does need to be a fuller story of just how much dislocation, detention, surveillance, and then ultimately going out into the wilderness has been part of the immigrant experience.
And there's always the tension between assimilation and the fear of losing your uniqueness. But these days there's airplane travel. Yeah. And so you can more easily maintain ties to the culture that you had. You can go back and forth if you can afford the plane ticket. And of course, we're talking about these old days where people came from Europe, where it would be days or weeks on a boat. If people are coming from Mexico or elsewhere in the Western Hemisphere, it's easier to go back and forth, even by car. And so there isn't the same romance of, I'm going to America to start over.
Right.
You are still connected to your family in more cases and in more ways than in those old, old days. And that creates that, you know, one foot in each world kind of experience more than people had 100 years ago.
Although we should mention that, especially for Italian immigrants, it was more of a circular migration where I think probably a quarter of Italian immigrants who came to the U.S. actually went back to Italy. So there was a little bit of that. But certainly you're right that with travel options now in non-pandemic times, there's much more flow back and forth.
All right. Well, we will leave it there. And that brings us to the end of the show. Nicole Hemmer, thanks to you as always.
Thank you, Jody.
And Brian Lehrer, thank you. This has been really, really fun to chat with you again, Brian. Nice to see you.
Great to see you. And thanks for having me. It's a great podcast.
Brian's show, of course, is on 10 to noon every day on WNYC. And there is the national podcast. You can also listen to the local show on a podcast. Are you still doing the weekend edition of the podcast, Brian?
Yeah, you originated that.
I did. I wasn't setting you up. I was just curious. I did. So, yes, I listened to all of it. So thank you, Brian. This Day in Esoteric Political History is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a network of independent, listener-supported, artist-owned podcasts. So if you would like to support us directly or support the work of Radiotopia in general, you can do so. There's a form on our website, thisdaypod.com. Our researcher and producer is Jacob Feldman. Our producer is Brittany Brown. Get in touch with any questions or comments about the show. You can email us, thisdaypod@gmail.com, or find a contact form at thisdaypod.com. My name is Jody Avergan. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Radiotopia.